to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm really excited because I'm here with Chuck Wendig, who many of you know. Hi Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So just to, for those people who haven't met Chuck before, Chuck is a novelist, a screenwriter, a game designer. He's also the author of Blackbirds, Mockingbird and Double Dead, as well as a host of ebooks on writing. And he has a brilliant blog on terribleminds.com. So Chuck, I've been following you, I guess, probably about a year now.
Thank you.
Yeah, about a year. But it seems like you've done so much. Can you give us a sort of brief overview of your creative journey?
Oh, brief? That's a hard one. I've been doing this. Well, I had my first short story published when I was 18. So that was 18 years ago, which is totally terrifying to me right now. In fact, I think I just had heart palpitations. 18 years. So I had that published, and I always thought I'd be a novelist. And it turned out that I wrote horrible novels. And I wrote five or six very bad novels, including one called Blackbirds that was unfinished and terrible at the time. And building up to that point, I worked in the game industry, also to sort of whet my writing stone a little bit. And from there, I went to a screenwriting thing. I won a screenwriting contest, a competition which was a cheat for me, and then I was trying to learn how to adapt my own horrible piece of crap novel Blackbirds to the screen to fix it and then back to transition it back to a novel. That worked. I won the contest. I got the mentorship. I did learn how to turn Blackbirds into a proper novel. Mm. And part of the secret there was outlining. Apparently, I need to outline if I'm going to actually write books. So from there, I got Blackbirds published, and Double Dead was in the process. And then I had this blog and writing books, and I work in transmedia. There was an Emmy nomination at one point, which is very exciting, for a project called Collapsus. The screenwriting thing took off. I did went to the Sundance Screenwriters Lab with my writing partner, Lance Weiler. So it's been I've been doing a lot, really, all over the fact that now that I'm saying it all out, I might need a nap.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what are you now then? What comes first? Like when people say, what are you? What do you say? Is it author? Is it screenwriter? What is it?
I just go with writer. Or the occasionally cheeky pen monkey, just because I write so much. I mean, if I have to put something front and center, novels are where it's at, just because they're paying the bills right now, more than anything else. For a while, it was freelance game work that was paying the bills, but the novel thing, like somewhere in the last year, I developed for myself a career in novel writing. Like I have four books out now, I guess, right? Blackbirds, Mockingbird, Double Dead, Dinocalypse Now, and then actually Bait Dog, which is a self-published thing. And then I have another seven books I've got due in the next 2 years. So, I'm on fire. And I mean, literally I'm actually on fire. I don't mean a good way. I mean,
I can see that you, and we're going to come back to your productivity in a minute, but first I want to talk about Blackbirds and Mockingbird, because I'm not a horror reader, but I downloaded a sample. I mean, I love your style of writing, and anyone should have a look at your blog at least. But when I read Blackbirds, I was captivated by Miriam Black. You write this awesome woman. She's nasty and kick-ass, and you know, there's so much there. So first of all, where is this dark and twisty stuff come from, do you think? You know, where do you get your sort of, what draws you to this sort of horror stuff?
I don't know, but I've always been that way. I've always been kind of a weird kid. When I was a kid, one of the first things I drew was this, and I don't know why. I don't even know, first of all, who let me watch Aliens, the movie Aliens, as a young child, but they did. And I was horrified, but at the same time, completely compelled by the horror. And so one of the earliest, I actually wanted to be a cartoonist very early on. And one of the first comic book / cartoons I drew was this weird buddy-up adventure with Pac-Man and the Xenomorphs from Aliens. I don't know. It's the worst and stupidest mashup in the history of mashups. And yet, so it was it was kind of dark and strange. I don't mean really grim, but it's just odd. So I was always sort of attracted to that stuff, and I read a lot of horror as a kid, and I tend to lean toward darker stuff. I mean, I like lighter stuff, too. I think there's value to that type of thing, but, you know, I mean, some of it just comes from the fact that in terms of narrative, conflict really comes best when it's maybe from a darker place.
No, and I found the book, I mean, particularly Mockingbird, goes much darker, I think.
In some ways, yeah, it really does. It's more, Mockingbird is probably a little more horror than Blackbird's is. Blackbird's has a crimier element to it, but with the serial killer vibe, with Mockingbird, it definitely gets that Silence of the Lambs-y tweak to it. And it sometimes, like, I was actually rereading Blackbird's as I was rewriting Mockingbird, and I was really disturbed by myself. I was like, what is wrong with me? I should really probably see help, some serious help.
Well, I we're going to come back. So many things I want to ask you, but I want to deal with that right now because my husband is one of my first readers, I guess, and he said he was reading one of my latest draft, and I've got, you know, some ritual sex murder in an ancient Egyptian tomb, and he's like, where did this come from? And I'm like, well, I don't really know, but you know, is it all right? So can you kind of help us, those of us who are quite nice people like you and I, but have these dark things, you know, is it okay? Are we psychologically okay?
I think it has to be, because first of all, people read this stuff and other people write this stuff, and I think some of the in the author community, some of the nicest people have been the horror authors. Which is either A, because they're like purging it, it's like an infection, they've purged all that stuff and now they're just all light and unicorns, or it's a ruse and they're planning on killing us and skinning us a lot. It's just a fake, you know, they're like sociopaths. I'm hoping it's the former because I feel like I'm not a sociopath, but time will tell.
Yeah, and is it that as writers we can address things that everybody's scared of, you know, well, in that way?
I think every novel and every story is at its core a horror story. Not in this squicky, gore-soaked, viscera-laden sense, but in the fact that we're all scared of something. I mean, one of those key things they tell you about characters is to figure out what they're afraid of, and then often make them confront their fears. And then by proxy, because the character, the protagonist, is something we are meant to associate with in a deeper way, and by proxy, we're really asking the audience to confront fears, which is ultimately the goal of horror, but then it becomes the goal of sort of all storytelling.
No, absolutely. So Miriam Black, I find is incredibly memorable, and I know you have a post on creating memorable characters, but I wondered if you would just give us, you know, sort of your two top tips for how do we make such a memorable and original character?
Oh God, two top tips for memorable and original characters. One, I feel like they have to be, and this sounds stupid, but they have to be interesting. They have to be active and interesting. They have to do stuff. You often find a trend sometimes where characters are very passive. Some writers, and I did this very early on, try to capture like an everyman vibe because we're sort of told that the everyman vibe, everyone can relate to it. But ultimately, the everyman vibe just isn't that interesting. You can make it interesting, but you have to be very good to be able to turn that, you know, kind of lead into gold. And you look at a character like House from the TV show House. He's an erasable, kind of horrible person, and yet there's something in there that sort of makes it, he makes him a compelling character. And then there's a tip, actually, I cite this tip. This is not my tip. This is a tip from a book called Save the Cat, which is very early on. You need to sort of learn, the character needs to have a Save the Cat moment, which we can get behind them. I don't necessarily think it needs to be a Save the Cat moment in that we're getting behind them as a good person. But I think we do need to see some their own ethos and wants and desires and fears sort of in action in a cool way. That really sort of drives us to know their story.
No, that's really good. And Miriam is really interesting. So for people who don't know, she touches people and she can see their death, right?
Right. Yeah, she can see how they're going to die, both when and how, but not where. And that complicates her life a little bit. And it makes her sort of a really twist. Because it happens early on, happens as a teenager, that she develops this and then she runs away and she's on the road for a number of years before the book begins. And she believes she can't change it. That's sort of the crux of Blackbird's is that she thinks fate has pretty much screwed her. It screwed the pooch totally. So she thinks she can't change it. So what that leads her to live a life of is like a vulture. She picks the bones of the dead, so to speak. Takes their wallets, keys, watches, calculator watches, shiny, awesome calculator watches. whatever she can do. And then once she meets a person who she responds to, he's possibly is a character named Lewis, who is possibly the only nice character in the whole book. I mean, like, genuinely a nice guy.
Mm.
Only a nice person in the book. Everyone else is sort of awful by some degree. And she learns that he's going to die, and then the question becomes, is she somehow complicit in his death, and then is there a way to change it? So once again, she takes on the battle of fate versus free will. So.
Mm. No, it's excellent. And I wondered also, because I get this, and you're a man, right? And I get this.
I'm told that. Every once in a while.
I think I get these comments just because I'm a girl, but I get people who say, you know, you're a woman, how can you write these types of violent things? But you're a man, you've written a female protagonist who is really, really violent. Do you ever get any comments on the gender stuff?
Oh, man, that's probably one of the biggest complaints I have, is anytime I see a bad review, I can usually be sure that the bad review is going to talk about one of two things. One, that I have a foul, foul mouth, and the book is sodden with vulgarity. Like, I reread it again. I'm like, my editor didn't take any of these out. There's, well, okay. So the second thing is about that I'm a man writing a female character and that it feels like she's a dude. And I mean, I'll cop to that. There's a male component to her. She's a very tough, survivalist type of character. That being said, I don't think that she is an unreal female protagonist. Mm. I've known people like Miriam. I have met Miriam in some guise among multiple people. She's a character I'm drawing from real humans, real female humans. So I don't think it's impossible that someone like that is a girl or a woman, but it was tricky, you know, as far as criticism, to how do you respond to that? And then every once in a while you get the criticism, or I get the criticism, that men should not write women at all, which then ends a weird, it's an impossible criticism, because am I supposed to just write books about white middle class dudes? Like, is that like,
yeah, that's ridiculous.
Over and over again. That's all I can do.
Yeah, no, and I really like the fact that Miriam is a woman, because I'm totally with you, and I think women are, you know, as dark and twisty, or possibly more dark and twisty than men.
Sure. Yeah, right? Well, that's the hope, right? I mean, you know. And, you know, I don't want to ascribe to the theory that women are like one thing.
Yeah, but, no. Anybody's one thing.
No, it's romantic. And it's like, I don't know. Miriam is a hard, and she's been on the road for like 6 years, and I just read Run Review that was like, how does she know how to fight? I'm like, I don't, first of all, do I need a whole book devoted to how she learned how to fight? Is that a thing? Second, well, she's been on the road for 6 years, and it's not like she's some kung fu master. She's a dirty, you know, it's like first sand in eyes, you know, stab you with a bottle type of fighter. It's not, there's no aplomb or finesse.
No, it's excellent. So I want to get deeper into the kind of the bravery side then, because I do find myself self-censoring things because of, you know, like you, I have a bit of an internet presence now and I'm out there and people know who I am. So I'm starting to write things under another name that people don't know because I'm afraid. I'm actually afraid. So I wanted to bring that to you and say, for people who are afraid of sharing, like, honestly, what do you say to them?
Sharing honestly in terms of,
like, really, what's in your head?
So, like, not fiction. You're talking about real, like, real life
No,
stuff.
No, I mean fiction. Like, writing fiction that's scary and wrong in some way and that people will attack you for, you know.
Well, for me, I mean, I did it and I got published. So I can't say it's always a bad idea. You know, I do have a series of young adult novels coming out with Amazon Children's Publishing. And there is the occasional discussion of whether or not I'll go with a pseudonym. And it'll be a known pseudonym, not like a hide it. I mean, the people know what the books are and that I'm the guy behind them. But just to not confuse, like, teenagers who pick up the one book and then they're like, well, Blackbirds is probably also a young adult. It's totally not young adult. Of course, on the other side, I read stuff like that when I was a teenager and I turned out just fine. Mm. So I don't know, you know, you do it. And then if it's too dark, you know, someone will tell you that, right? I mean, there's beta readers, there's editors, there's agents. Someone's going to step in and say, well, maybe this is a little too edgy. And there was like one or two things in Blackbirds. There were very small things, but there were just a hair over the edge that we pulled back on, obviously.
Really? I'm amazed.
Yeah, believe it or not.
Yeah. No, that's...
It was an ending to Mockingbird that I pulled back on.
Hmm.
I won't share that because it's a grim secret, but it was a dark, dark ending. It's a dark ending.
Oh, well, that's good. It's good to hear that, actually. So let's get back into your writing style. Now, although I guess you're in the kind of horror genre, I think that your writing could be classed as literary. What do you think about that?
I mean, I have a literary background. I studied English, and I adore certain literary voices. So I'm not opposed to that distinction. I don't mind being in a genre sense with a literary vibe to it. I think language is really cool, and I like to play with language and get into the nitty gritty of the narrative, theme, and mood, and all those little flibbertigibbets. Gibbets. So sure, I'll take it. So I think someone who was Stephen Blackmore, fellow author, great author. He has a book called Dead Things coming out, which is great. He said something like some of the work in Blackbirds and Mockingbirds sounds like poetry. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, I find your writing like it's beautiful, and like you had a post today on your blog, the Battle Song of the Storyteller.
I do that once a year during November, some kind of crazy, insane call to action, and those posts are like I uncork the bottle and I let whatever pours out. I just write insane stuff for those posts.
No, it's a great post, and it's full of examples of your descriptive writing and your metaphor. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you come up with some things that are really tangential. Do you have a process for that? Or, you know, how do you think you come up with that stuff?
I don't know. Metaphor is weird, because it's hard. I mean, metaphor is you're purposefully trying to combine two things that don't belong together. You can't combine two things that look alike. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know, you can't say like, well, you know, the deer looked like a moose. Like, it's like stupid. It's meaningless. It has to be something. The way it moved has to be unusual, and it has to draw the reader in an interesting way, visually and emotionally, and you know, almost psychologically, to a point. And what you're doing is, as an author, you're sort of imprinting. I think metaphors are like fingerprints. They tell you more about how the author's mind works than a lot of things that are contained in the book. I mean, character and everything does, plot and everything does, story. But the general construction of a sentence does not tell you necessarily how a writer's mind works. But metaphor is like a little peek and a pinhole through the door into the author's weird, weird brain. And there are some authors who do that very well. Joe Lansdale, his like every other sentence is a great and bizarre metaphor, and they work. I don't mean bizarre in a non-functional way. If they're too bizarre, they fall off the cliff and die in the ocean somewhere. But so they really have to be, you know, right and weird at the same time. So I don't know how I think it up. It's just part of it is thinking visually, just taking a walk and taking photos and just seeing what things look like in an unexpected way. There was a very brief story. When I was a kid, I did not wear glasses, and I did not know that my eyes were complete turds in my face, just useless pieces of crap stuck in my head. And so I was outside one day and I saw a bird, a pheasant, like a cockbird. And I was like, well, it's not moving, so it's clearly wounded. So I'm like, I'm going to go and I sneak up on this bird. I'm going to see what it is and I'll grab it. And I don't know why I was going to grab the bird. I thought I was going to do with it, choke it. I have no idea what my goal was. So as I crept up on the bird, and I literally got within like 2 feet, and I realized it's really just a rock. Because I had bad vision, horrible vision. But that was telling for me also in a metaphorical sense, in that the rock looked like a bird, and it was just, you know, neither of those, you don't usually think rocks and birds are associated together, but there was a telling moment in that little broken-eyed boy that I was.
No, I like that. So that is kind of seeing things differently.
Yeah. So maybe what I'm trying to tell people is mess up your eyes. Take off your glasses and
well, that's pretty. I wear contact lenses. I'm completely blind, so yeah. You know, well, not completely, but you know. So you said that you take photos and things. Do you like carry a notebook and write stuff down as you see good metaphors and descriptions?
I don't generally. I will sometimes. I have my phone on me most of the times as a modern techno whore. I can't leave my phone anywhere. So I will, if I need to, take like an audio note. Awful cool. But generally speaking, I because they're so, like, when I see something in the moment, it's rare that that's the type of thing that's ever going to come back. Like, I need to talk about this tree. I don't. It's not, no one else is going to get it. But what it does do, I mean, you know, if we're to assume that this sort of thing, this creative thing that we do is a muscle in some way, that I think exercising that muscle with metaphors and that is itself a metaphor, is useful and will continue to help you do it as you go.
Hmm. And then I'm interested, like at the beginning you said that Blackbirds has been around for ages and it was terrible and you rewrote it and you did a script and then it's back to a novel. And how is some of this language stuff the reason it's become better, or is it a completely different story? I mean, how did you take it from crap to being so brilliant?
There were two things. First of all, learning to outline. I am a pantser by heart and a plotter by necessity. I would love to just be able to, like, I'm just going to write. And, like, you know, that was always my dream. And I was always like, you can't oppress me with your outlines. And, you know, the screenwriting mentor, Steven Susko, who wrote both Rudge Films and Jack Ketchum's Red adaptation, he was like, well, you have to outline. I was like, yeah, no, I'm like, no, I don't do that. I'm sorry. Maybe you come from the screenwriting world, but I come from novel land where we all, you know, do our happy artistic muse dance. And I'm like, I'll do a ritual in the woods and it'll all just come to me. And he's like, no, you're going to outline. So I outlined grudgingly and painfully and gnawing my nails to the quick. And it turns out that totally worked, because what I didn't have with the story was a plot that made sense that I could hang anything on. So I was able to outline it and then turn it into a screenplay. And the screenplay taught me a lot about language, in that you still need to be in a screenplay, right? I mean, I'm not talking about a shooting script, but like a spec script. It's a script that's still meant to be read. Even though it's a blueprint, the script is itself kind of a bare bones outline that's meant to be translated to another form. It still has to be a compelling read. So the dialogue still has to crackle. Those description bars need to be evocative without being pages long. You can't sit there and take a half a page to describe something. You just can't, because each page is a minute of screen time. So the more you do that, the more you lose. So it taught me, well, okay, you really need to be sharp and short with your language, but also still throw in interesting visuals and interesting little hooks that compel the eye and compel the mind. So I translated that sort of back to the novel writing process and said, well, I'm going to take that sort of ethos with language and a little make it sort of a short, sharp shock of language, but still with a little visual jazz hands, if possible.
Thing that I find really interesting about you is you are kind of an example of the hybrid author who is combining traditional publishing with indie publishing. So do you think that's the best way if people can do it? And what do you reckon about this whole indie trad thing?
Well, the reason that I think it's the best way is because I do it. No, it's horrible logic. I should go that way. Do whatever I do. No, don't. The reason I think it's a good idea is because diversity is a really powerful thing, both in nature and nature, diversity, that's the thing. That's how things survive, how species survive. If you have a lawn that's all one grass seed and that grass gets hit by a drought that affects it or some sort of pest or parasite, then your lawn is all dead. People look at our lawn, we live in the woods, and people look at our lawn and they're like, oh, it's green, it's so lush and beautiful. But if you get close, it's actually all weeds. Our lawn is just a weed bed, but it's kept short and mowed short, and it's in the worst droughts, it's emerald green. And part of that is because diversity allows it to survive. So if one weed dies, there's still a whole filthy nest of other weeds waiting to take over over the territory. So what you get with traditional and quote-unquote indie publishing is you get this two sides of things, that if one should fail, the other is there to support you. And they also feed off each other. Like, I know there were points at which some people were questioning maybe if I shouldn't do the one thing and shouldn't do the indie side, or should, you know, focus on the other side. But the opportunities that have been afforded by both could not exist unless I did both. Having my young adult novel get published with Amazon, and with what was a deal that was frankly very good for me, was in part lent off the fact that I had two Kickstarters that I was a part of. One was my young adult series, Atlanta Burns, with Fate Dog, and the other one was kind of a middle grade young adult, at least in terms of tone and subject matter, pulp novel called Dinocalypse Now for the Spirit of the Century role-playing game. So both those things sort of lent themselves up to it. And yet, on the other hand, the experiences that I've had with Blackbirds and Mockingbird, I could have never had I self-published them. And I'm not talking about just sales numbers. What people will talk about is pure sales numbers, and that's what you often get with the indie community. Everyone's like, oh, it's, you do so much sales and you control the thing and you get 70%, and that's the best thing ever. It is at a very basic math level, but what it doesn't tell you is that there's things that you don't get with self-publishing. You don't get great reviews. You don't get your book in unexpected hands. I can't tell you how many I got to pitch to incredibly awesome people at film companies out in LA because they got a copy of Blackbirds without me having any. It just happened. They just got it. And I had another company, a comics company, talk to me, and just things that like Blackbirds falls into people's hands. And I've had foreign rights sold, in multiple places. So it's like all these things sort of build on top of each other. And yet Blackbird sort of also gets attention from the indie side. So what they do is they sort of work together. There's no competition. That's the whole, I don't know why people feel the need that these two things need to compete. Not, they can work very well together and perhaps probably should.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's my aim too. But no, and on that, I mean, I saw Mockingbird, I think, reviewed in The Guardian in Britain, and that's like one of the most highbrow papers in the country. Maybe it was Blackbirds.
I think Blackbirds was. Maybe it was. I think it was.
But I was like, and when I saw it, I was like, wow, that's amazing, because they only review about 5 books a week, and you made it. And I was like, there's no way that would happen with an indie book.
No. Indie books are held at arm's length, and sadly so, because I think there's a really awesome number of incredible indie books out there that will just never get the attention they deserve. That's the other myth too, is a lot of the indie sort of proselytes will tell you that, you just write the greatest book you write, and it's the greatest cover, and because it's indie, it's just going to float to the top, and cream floats, and it doesn't though. In fact, a lot of the really bad stuff floats, and a lot of the really great stuff sinks. True in traditional publishing as well. So I don't mean it's not indie's fault, but it doesn't. Indie is not a solution in and of itself.
No, I agree. And just in terms of, other things, I mean, you blog a lot as well. I mean, you blog almost every day.
Monday through Friday.
Yeah, so you blog a lot, and a lot of people will say, stop blogging, keep writing. But your blog seems, I mean, I heard of you through blogging, and I'm sure a lot of people have. How has your blog fitted in with your fiction? Because you seem to do both.
I have no proof that it helps. I think it helps. I've met a number of people who have found me, obviously, via the blog, and I have a very big audience both on Twitter and the blog at this point over the last year that, for some reason, people feel the need to actually listen to the crap that I say online. What is wrong with you people? I think it helps in that I feel like my sales are strong, and I both in terms of publishers and editors and stuff, I think they're pleased that I have the platform, which I don't consider a platform so much as just an audience. I mean, an audience is really what you're looking for. I mean, I think it works, but I also don't have any numbers. It's not like I'm like, I can say, well, I get this X number of people on my blog and this percentage of them has bought my book. I have no idea. But I do see every day that I have my links, on the side, my Blackbirds, Mockingbirds, and all my writing book links on the side, and I do see that people are clicking out to those fairly frequently. So fingers crossed it has some aggregate
And you enjoy it, right, as well?
blogging, on and off. Every once in a while, it's a little frustrating, not because of anything anyone does, just because it is time consuming, and I have to take time like on the weekends to do it because my writing schedule through the week doesn't really afford that. And there are sometimes I'm like, maybe I should stop doing this, but ultimately, then I find some reason that I want to blog again, and then it all, then I love it again. So.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then, like you mentioned, your writing schedule there. So you seem to be incredibly prolific, and you talk about, and I love the way you talk about, working hard. So can you tell us about a bit about that? What are any tips for productivity, and what does your week look like?
I tend to wake up usually around 6 in the morning, and I will write until I am done, which generally means 2 to 3,000 words a day. Every once in a while, I'll do significantly more than that, but that's not by I don't force myself to do that. There's no gun to my head, which would be really weird if I held a gun to my own head. I write that, I hit that mark, and then I cool down and whatever happens in the middle of the day, lunch and. Whatever pornography, I don't know, whatever happens in the middle of your day. And then from there, I tend to do editing in the afternoon or other administrative stuff like answer whatever emails have piled up over my head, which are usually in the hundreds and often not useful. Email feels like drowning. I'm just telling you that right now. There needs to be a more efficient email. And I don't mean like email needs to go away and there needs to be something more effective in its place.
Like
Google
Twitter.
kind of tried that. What's that?
Like Twitter.
Like Twitter. if we could all just tweet at each other, it would be so much more effective. Force me to conform to 140 characters. That'd be great.
Yeah, so you basically do write every day on fiction.
Yeah, especially because right now that's what I have to do. I say that in a good way, like it's a great thing I have to do that. I literally have 7 novels I'm on track. I have to write. People are making me write these, which is great. Because it means I'm going to be fed for the next, and my family will be clothed, and we'll have mortgage payments paid, roof over our head, for the next 2 years.
So that's brilliant. And I just have one more question, and I don't know whether you can answer it, but you've mentioned several times that about a year ago something happened, and you know, things took off, your blog took off, the book took off. Do you know what happened? Was it critical mass? You know, what do you think was the sort of crux of things?
I feel like it was critical mass. I had just a bunch of stuff happen, Double Dead and Blackbirds, and I had already come off the Sundance Screenwriting Lab, and it was just like the blog was starting to really do very well in terms of people reading it and communicating it to each other, and then Twitter is a big thing that happened. I think some authors underestimate Twitter, some don't, obviously many don't, but Twitter is phenomenal. I'm talking to people I should never be allowed to talk to, but on Twitter I can. I mean, the fact that I was able to interview Margaret Atwood at Terrible Minds is absurd.
Awesome.
And I even told her, I'm like, this can only hurt you and help me. It can't. It will not increase your profile in any way, shape, or form. You're already good to go. You do not need to do this. And she was still very kind enough to do it. And she retweets the blog every once in a while, and I meet these great authors, and they're just funny, phenomenal people. Proving that writers are actually fairly nice, generally speaking. I mean, sometimes they're total dickbags, but generally speaking, they're very nice. So Twitter has been a huge thing. I always say it's like, you know, sometimes writing is like feeling you're in the middle of a lake and your audience is on the shore and you're just trying to reach them with ripples. So it's like, you know, Twitter is a great way to sort of throw as many pebbles as you can, and you really never know. Doesn't even take a big audience on Twitter to reach a big audience, because there's always someone out there that has that. So it's very, Twitter is definitely a very big thing. Not Facebook, not Google+, which I think now is like a boneyard. I think Google+ is a boneyard. I think they're burying digital corpses in Google, sadly.
Yeah, but and we should remind everyone, though, that at the beginning you said it's been 18 years. So even though this 1 year...
Oh, yeah, no, this is not a fast process. No, I mean, this is like a... one foot in front of the other, very long process. I don't think it will always take everyone 18 years. I mean, every writer is a totally different animal. Getting into the heart of the publishing mountain is every writer digs his own tunnel and detonates it behind him. There's not, I can't tell you how many different stories you hear as to how people do that. Mm-hmm. You know, my experience is getting an agent, my experience is getting published are going to be wildly different from how everyone else does it and did it. So, you know, that's where writing advice and talking about the blog and all that stuff is useful, in the sense that it's interesting and you may find things that are valuable to you. And certainly any pieces of information you glean from these places you should use and feel great about. But ultimately, none of it is gospel, and there's nothing that you should read that says like, oh my God, this is my new Bible, I'm going to follow it pound for pound, line for line, because it probably won't work. Mm-hmm. Gotta find.
No, fantastic. Right. So where can people find you and your books online?
Oh, heavens. The best place to start is either my website, which is www.terriblemindsminds.com. Is it my mind? Then on Twitter, which is first name, last name, Chuck Wendig, Chuck Wendig. Not Wending, because people misspell it that way, or Wingding. I'm not Wending. I can be Wendigo if you feel like I should be a Native American spirit who will eat your frozen heart. My books are available, obviously, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and hopefully your favorite indie bookseller and library and Walmart and Target and airport. And then they're not available at those places. I wish they were.
Brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Chuck. That was great.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!